From WBEZ Chicago, this is When Magic Happens. I'm Jennifer Shea Love Bowers, here with Cheryl Jackson and Taylor Coward. Happy Mother's Day to all the mamas and mother figures. And in honor of Mother's Day, we're sharing the mic with our own mamas. Throughout this episode, you'll hear real, candid conversations with our mothers. And some of these stories we get into, even we haven't heard. There's a lot of laughter, a lot of love, and a lot of magic. More after the break.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
My mom is like the glue of the family. She keeps us together, she loves us fiercely, and she is the strongest person I know. It wasn't until around this time last year that I learned about the difficulties that she experienced while she was giving birth to me. And after hearing that story, I've come to admire my mom even more. I wanted to find out more about her pregnancy, the journey of childbirth for her, and I wanted to just sit down and talk with her. So here's me and my mom, Julie.
Hello, Mom.
Hello, Taylor.
What were some expectations of motherhood you had before you became a mom? Like, what did you think this was going to be like?
I didn't think that it was going to be like anything because I didn't plan to have children.
Okay.
So I didn't have a plan because I was really engaged in helping to raise my sister's children because she's chronically ill. She was diagnosed when they were babies. And so I thought I was going to be an eternal aunt. She had an 8-year-old and a set of twins and pretty much a newborn when she was diagnosed. So all of my time and efforts were put into them. And I was married. And when I got pregnant, it was a shock to me. But it was then my reality. And my plan pretty much developed as I was expecting. And as you guys came into the world and I sought out your needs and then the things that I wanted for you, I started to incorporate into my parenting style. There are certain things that I was like, oh, I'd never do that if I, and I would never do it this way and I would never do it that way. Then I found out that you should never say never.
Yeah.
Because you really don't know until you are in a particular situation.
What's an example of a thing you were like, I'll never do?
Something that I always said I would never do and I didn't do, maybe once, maybe twice, was physical punishment.
Okay.
You know, I'm not going to fight my kids.
Yeah.
And it was one thing that was really important to me that you can attest to. And that was a great start to your morning.
Yeah.
Which is why I developed the whole
medley
morning medley song that I was singing to you guys. I think that waking people up, waking my children up in a gentle and loving way starts off your day.
Yeah.
In a positive and I think it worked.
Yeah.
I think it worked.
Love the morning medley. So what is like the first thing you did? Because I could see the like, really your whole life changes as soon as you find out you're pregnant. So like, what did you do next?
I wouldn't necessarily know that there were any steps that I took.
I mean, did you call anybody?
Oh.
Did you say, damn?
Yeah, I did the Florida damn, drop the bowl, the whole thing. Yeah. And for those of you who may not know, in reference to Good Times, when I told Rick, my husband, your dad.
My dad. My father.
Oh, your father. He was excited. He was like, oh, we're going to have a little bambino. And I just was like, yeah.
You were like, damn.
What? I took precautions. What in the world? So I said, well, you know, obviously this is what God intended for me. And it was a shock.
Yeah.
It was a shock.
But you didn't have a Florida Evans moment. You didn't damn and drop the
ball. Yeah, I did. But, you know, I was in nursing school.
Oh my gosh. I know.
And it was beyond challenging.
Yeah.
To continue to render care to my sister and to her children and be a full-time nursing student and take care of myself so that you would be healthy. So it was a lot. It was a lot to juggle.
I don't think I've ever considered how inconvenient that is, having a kid while you're like toward kind of the middle to end of school, right?
Yeah, yeah. You were born 3 weeks before my graduation.
Which makes me feel like I'm a registered nurse.
Yes, you know, nurse by proxy.
Yeah, I went through school.
You went through nursing school. And so it was interesting. I had these older nursing instructors. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that they said to me, pretty much in unison, was, "You ain't the first person to be pregnant."
Okay.
And this don't stop anything.
Wow.
And it didn't. I delivered you April 17th and April 20th. I was back in class.
Wow.
All in all, it has been an incredible journey. Mm. Motherhood changed my life for the better in ways that I never would have imagined. Mm. To see two people evolve into these wonderful individuals, I just am so incredibly blessed. Mm. And I owe most of that to God, you know. All of it, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, I just say that I was given these wonderful, beautiful slates, you know, to build on. Mm-hmm. And so I feel blessed and highly favored that you all are the people that you are. And it's interesting how you came into the world. I thought you were this real dark chocolate baby, but because you came into the world and you was, you know, your fist was balled and you were screaming and you were so mad. And I think it's because we woke you up
early
and you were hungry.
Abruptly.
You know, right. Abruptly. And you were hungry. And I was like, wow. And you have that fiery spirit to this day. And Julian came into the world and wasn't crying, but was just kind of looking around. And yeah. I was like, I thought babies couldn't see. What is he looking at? You know, and he was just cool and just laid back. And as you know, that is him to this day. Yeah. And so that's something that always is amazing to me.
Yeah.
That you all kept those personalities, exactly how you came into the world. It's a beautiful memory. How you both came into the world.
I'm glad you got the best of both worlds. It would be a lot to have two of me.
Two of you.
And it would be quiet to have two of Julian.
Two of Julian. Absolutely. One kid that was, you know, really outgoing. One was very introverted. You know, he mm-hmm. found his way. He found his niche. He definitely came out of his shell. And then one kid who ate everything, one who ate nothing.
I just saw him today eating just a granola bar. Yeah. I'm like, I've had 3 eggs, a piece of toast, right. A cup of coffee. What is like the best advice you've received from anybody about motherhood?
Put God first. Mm. That was instilled in me from my mother, from May and Sugar, moms.
Yeah.
You know, you can be educated, you can be well-rounded, you can be well-versed. Mm-hmm. You can be well-financed, mm-hmm. but if you don't have your faith grounded in the Lord and Jesus, then you are going to falter. Mm-hmm. And so it's always been my hope that even if you stray from your teachings of spirituality or whatever, that you will still have that foundation, mm-hmm. and that is what you hold on to. That is what you always steer back to. Hopefully you won't steer away from it, mm-hmm. you know, but things happen in life.
So you said I came out screaming, and I learned from this show, actually, that you had a very tough delivery.
I did.
With me. Why do you think that that's something we never talked about?
Because you don't have the type of mama that lays a guilt trip on you. You know, I'm not the one to say, girl, you know how many hours I spend in labor and how many times they send me back home and had to do the amnio infusion. You better wash them dishes, you know.
Take out the trash. My teeth crumbled.
Yeah, you know, you took all the enamel out of my teeth. I think that we have conversations as they are needed.
Yeah.
You know, like we had a conversation when you were 10 about starting, you know, your menses because I was around the same age. Right. So those things that are hereditary or familial, mm-hmm. we talk about
yeah.
at that time.
Yeah.
It's timing.
Yeah,
it's
comes timing, up when it comes you
know? Up. Right.
But I did wonder, I was like, well, when would if I have found this out? Like, well, would you have dropped a warning once it was too late?
No, I mean, you know, as you know, after you've married and, you know, start considering around the time to start having children, that's something that we would talk about. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like if I talk to you now about, now you can expect to probably start, you know, perimenopause around, you know.
Yeah.
Just not...
Not the time.
The time.
Okay. Well, to prepare for that time, I'm wondering what is like one thing you would want me to know as a mother one day?
Start putting aside money for college.
Yeah.
Like tomorrow.
Who knows how much college is going to be then?
I don't know, but as you know, it has been very challenging.
Yeah.
But you guys are educated.
Yep, degreed.
You know, you are degreed. So if you are doing this on your own, which I pray you're not, mm-hmm. you know, then you know it is incredibly challenging. It takes a lot of sacrifice and hard work mm-hmm. to educate your children. Do what you want to do for yourself in terms of travel and education and whatever it is your plans are for yourself, do them before you have children.
Mm.
Because you don't want to have regrets.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to look back on things that you wanted to do and then you can't do them because you now have someone else you're responsible for.
Yeah.
So do those things that you want to do while you are single, while you are young, mm-hmm. and before you... a mother.
Mm-hmm. What were the most important values that you wanted your kids to have?
Oh, a sense of God, a relationship with God, a relationship with yourself,
mm-hmm.
to like yourself, to take care of yourself, to protect, build, and well, establish and protect your credit.
Mm-hmm.
To learn how to save.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, you guys have been exceedingly good with that.
Mm-hmm.
You have. So those were things that were important to me because they were struggles for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want them to be struggles for you.
Yeah.
To not be caught up on materialistic things.
Yeah.
Some things come and go. And to also know that relationships come and go.
Yeah.
That people and situations in life have seasons,
mm-hmm.
and that you can rely on God, you can rely on yourself.
Yeah.
Moments that made me personally proud have been things like you taking your grandmother to church mm-hmm. when you didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Or just ways in which you guys show humility and humanity.
Mm.
When you sacrifice your Saturday nights to put together the baskets that we would go hand out to the homeless people
mm-hmm.
up under 18th Street.
Yeah.
And never complaining how you take care of your grandfather, making sure he takes his medicine and he's had his food, that he... safely up and down the stairs. Those moments are moments that let me know that you have in you some of the things that I thought were important,
mm.
which is sense of family and responsibility. Those moments make me very, very proud.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Ask Curious City anything about the Chicago area. Yeah, anything.
My dad was reminded of a cafe on Sheridan called It's Here. So I was wondering if there's any information on the folk music scene in Chicago then and now.
Send your questions to wbez.org/curiouscity. And it could be the focus of a future episode.
My mom is like sunshine. She shines so bright. She's positive. And we talk almost every day. I can always be assured that when she answers the phone, it's going to be a, "Hey, Shay." Her love is unconditional. She's giving. And she's done so much for myself, her favorite child, and my brother. And you know what she would say? She would say her favorite daughter. And she has instilled a sense of adventure and freedom and can-do-itness. And I often wonder what made her focus on those values in particular. I wanted to hear more from her. Here's me and my mom, Florence.
Hey, Mom.
Hi, Shay.
How you doing, Mama?
I'm doing good, my favorite daughter.
Oh, see? Just say it. Just say it. Just say I am your favorite child.
I just gave you my special favor, my daughter. And if you'd like for me to elevate it, I can say my favorite only daughter. How about that?
Yeah, or you could just say favorite child and we just leave it at that. How about that? Mom, it's so fun talking to you. And one thing I always think about is you raising us. So, Mom, when you think about some of the values and ideals that were important to you and you wanted to instill in us, what were some of those things? Like, what were some of the, maybe your top three things that you wanted to make sure that we possessed?
Okay. Well, my top three, I really wanted you to identify as individuals, people, persons, personalities. And between you and your brother, listen, your personalities are distinct and defined, okay?
And I'm your favorite.
And you're my favorite daughter. But what I think is common is that I think both of you accepted a internal soul that was spiritual. And you did follow my discipline. I've even heard both of you say that I was pretty disciplined, though I don't think I was disciplined enough.
I think you were pretty disciplined.
Yeah, you said that. But listen, honey, when I look back over the years, I think about things that I could have even enforced and reinforced over and over, which I didn't.
Like, well, okay. I'm curious about this because two things.
Yes.
When you said you enforce things, there are specific things that I do remember that you enforced, right? So I distinctly remember I'd be talking on the phone and you were very adamant about language and words usage of words. And if I don't even remember what I used to say, I'd be like, "Hey, this is she or this is her." Which one was it?
I wanted you to be able to communicate completely and most of all in the right tense. Yeah. I didn't want you to be, communicating with someone at a level that gave them the impression that you could not speak English properly. So, yes, I did want you to communicate properly. Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the other things, in addition, I do find that you and your brother are still quite disciplined about certain things you can do and you can't do. And one of the things that I thought was always the funniest is I didn't want your little dirty hands touching my clean walls. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
That was one of my pet peeves, you know. And then the other thing is, if someone asks you a question, either about where you were in the moment or what are you doing or how was your day, what did you do positive today, I expected you to give an answer.
I do
I,
remember that.
you know, if you said nothing or I don't know, that was slapping reasons. I mean, no.
I do remember that.
You remember that?
I do. I definitely remember that. I also remember, like, you would, if we didn't know a word, if we didn't know the meaning of
Yes.
the word, you would always tell us to go look it up in the dictionary.
Look it up. Look it up. I mean, honestly, I mean, that's what the dictionary's for.
But I
Hello.
think when you think about like that discipline and structure, I think you really offered that to us in different kinds of ways. So even if it was the way in which we communicated, or I distinctly remember the making of your bed every morning, having the discipline to kind of start the day off by making up your bed, or I do also remember you having in the way we interacted with people, looking people in their eye. And
And can you think of the other way? When you look them in the eye, if you have to shake their hand, you better shake their hand with some confidence.
yes.
You're actually communicating to the other person that you know who you are and you feel good about it. You're
Yes.
confident.
Yes.
And that's displayed not only in your eyes, but in your handshake, in your language, in your communication. And honestly, as I look back over it, I think you and your brother accepted those because I see you as a developed person that is the example, even for your own children today. It's like you're passing those things down. And obviously, with your success and with your brother's success, it is working.
Why do you think those values in particular are important to pass down? Like,
Because we live in a society, Dollar, and you know this. It's becoming so global now. Global to the extent that you can't be mediocre. You've got to be above, always above, to even interact and be competitive in the world today. So, yeah, those are the foundational values that's necessary, you know, to be that person that's going to interact with this global society.
Why are those things in particular so important to you?
For me, because that's the foundation of making you a strong person out there in this rat race, girl. Because it's a rat race.
It is a rat race.
Rat race, but a lot of unlikely things that, you know, can upset you and make you move in a journey or a path that won't give you positive results.
What
And
are
so,
some of the things that your mom passed to you? Like, what, when you think about your ability to
yeah.
navigate even that rat race, what are some of the things that she passed on to you?
Well, what I saw in my mother, honey, was nothing but a fortified, strong woman, self-determined, like you, Shay, and goal setting, identified with what she wanted. And she instilled that in all of her kids. And with me being the firstborn, you know, it's something that I identified with early that I needed to have those skills so that I wouldn't be left behind. that I wanted to be that person. Number one, to make her proud. And I think I did that before she left this world, you know? I was her firstborn. I was the first female, technically, in her family lineage to graduate from college, and I know she was proud of that. And I wanted to pass that down because it's part of being stable as a human being also. I wanted to make sure that my kids would have that inner backbone. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, I completely get it. Because, okay, there was like a very healthy sense of, I don't know if it was fear or respect, but we never breached that. Why do you think that was?
I think that it was, I'm going to say it this way, and I have said this to my friends. I think as a parent, looking at my children, you and your brother accepted the guidelines. I never had any resistance to it. You were great children that just accepted, even to this day. And I remember this, Shay, and maybe you don't remember. What I instilled in you is what you were allowed to do and what you were not allowed to do. You remember that? So you were allowed to do certain things, but you were not allowed to put your hands on my clean walls, okay? You were allowed to sit at the dinner table, you know, and to use the right fork and the right knife and et cetera, but you were not allowed to do other things. So it was that thing. And whether you're conscious of it or not, I have noticed that sometimes when you and your brother come to visit, you ask me, "Well, Mom, are we allowed to eat this now? Are we allowed?" Do you remember that?
I do.
Well, I hope. Well, obviously, it left a good impression on you. You don't seem to be.
Well, you know what I think it did is when you
What?
talk about like the backbone that it instilled, right? Which
Yeah.
is just that structure, that discipline, but it was healthy structure and healthy discipline, right? So, like, for example, thinking about what we would eat, you know, is something like there always had to be a vegetable, or there was more water than there was juice. You know, it was always sort of
Yeah.
this healthy balance of, oh, can we have sweets after
Yeah.
a certain time of the day, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that structure and that discipline really is the foundation for even how I teach my kids to eat, you know?
Well,
And
it's the foundation.
yeah. And also, when you talk about language, you know, and being able to communicate your ideas, I completely agree with you now
Yes.
about the importance of being able to communicate when someone asks you a question, not saying I don't know or nothing, and having an answer. And
Good answer.
because what that does is it makes you think. You know, because by saying nothing to me, it's kind of like an easy out, you know?
I don't want
But
to participate in the conversation
right,
because
that's
an
right.
answer provides you with, you know, a conversation.
Yes,
Because
yes.
after you give a response, there's going to be another either question or continuation to your answer.
That's right.
So it's never nothing.
Yeah, no,
Never,
I
never.
agree.
So,
So, can I tell you one story that I do remember? I wonder if
uh-oh.
you remember this.
Try me.
But okay, remember we were going, I love that you guys used to take us to any kind of event, right? I loved that. And I remember this time I wore this red and black dress. Well, it wasn't a dress, it
Yes.
was like a top and a skirt.
Yes.
And I wanted to wear white tights with these black shoes. And
Oh, yes.
you told me no. You were basically like, hey, you should wear black tights with the black shoes,
And
right?
your shoes.
That's right. And I just remember pushing against that, you know, pushing against wanting to be my own individual, what I thought looked right. But actually, what you suggested was obviously it looked way better than wearing the white tights with the black shoes. But just little nuanced things like that. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. And honestly, not only do I remember it, I think I have a picture of that.
You do.
I do.
You do. Burn
No, I'm not going to burn it.
it.
But when you did it, you introduced something that Dad and I always did, even to some of the adult events that we attended. You and your brother escorted us to those events. And most of all, I think, I know that I wanted you to experience the environments that we were in. And it's interesting you bring that up, Shay, because believe it or not, some of our friends to this day notice that and have mentioned to me over the years that you always included your children. And it was a lesson for you too, so that you can see not only how we engage with other people, but what would be expected of you in certain environments.
I really appreciate you doing that because one, it prepared me for different kinds of environments to be in, right? And, you know, like even from what do you wear? You know, how do you behave? What is sort of the, I don't want to say protocol, but just, you know, as you're socializing, how do you move in this room versus moving in this room? And I think being exposed to those different kinds of things really was helpful in. As I went away to college, or even now, you know, being comfortable navigating all different kinds of spaces, regardless of like who's in the room.
I agree. And I'm glad I hear that you appreciated that, Shay. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, good,
Yeah.
good.
Well, Mom, I think you have done an extraordinary job as a mom. You are a beautiful person, and I love how, you know, one thing that I also remember you being is just always so optimistic about what we could do, you know, and guiding us to do those things, even though there were guidelines around it, you know, you always were very encouraging about the possibilities. And so I think that that has really impacted the way that I look at the world, and also the way that I have my kids look at the world. And I love you for that. So thank
Oh,
you for that.
Shay. Oh, you just touched my heart.
Well, I want to hug you.
Well, how about a virtual hug? Okay.
So my mom is the matriarch of our family and a legend. She is one of 11. Actually, all of her siblings have passed away, so she's the last sibling in our family, in her family, here with us. And she's also, a legend. She writes this amazing music. Actually, it's called oratorios. It's a combination of classical choral music with a religious theme, and it includes spoken word and narration. And her career has been nothing short of amazing. To go from being completely invisible in a world that's so dominated by white men, to having your works performed around the world and at Carnegie Hall with her latest premiere in Memphis by the Memphis Symphony and the National Civil Rights Museum. And when I look at her career, her life, she was one of 11, and she's the mother to obviously me and my four siblings. But with no formal training in music ever, never played an instrument, writing this completely amazing music that is stunning. But I've always been curious how she was motivated to do this work when there was no cheerleading, you know, cheerleader or group of people, you know, encouraging her, pushing her forward. It was just the power of her own dream and nothing else, and no one around her telling her that she can do it or encouraging her. I'm amazed by that. I'm also amazed that at 86, she continues to make new dreams and keep projects ahead of her. So, you know, I'm really curious about how she does that, how she did that, how she continues to do that, to dream, to keep the dream alive when no one else around you believes. And I'm excited about this conversation. I hope you are too. Before you had children or married or any of that, what were some of the dreams you had for yourself?
The first thing, I wanted to go to Fisk University, and I wanted to major in mathematics.
Wanted to major in mathematics. Did you know what you wanted to do with that?
Well, not just go as far as I could go with teaching math.
Oh, so you were thinking you'd be a teacher. You wanted to teach math. So that was your dream, to teach math at the high school level, college, or?
Well, I probably would start out with the high school in advance to colleges.
So that was your dream before marriage and children and all of that. As you were raising us, what dreams did you have or still have? Did that shift when you found yourself being married and five children in the South? This was after you went to Fisk, but you had to leave Fisk because your father died unexpectedly, didn't have the funds. So you left Fisk, moved to Chicago. You were putting yourself through college, you know, a year here, 6 months there, 2 years there. And then finally you got married. And then you moved back down south.
3 years.
Northwestern. So you were 3 years at Northwestern. But finally, you got married, moved down south, and you moved down south, and you have five kids. Did your dreams, did they shift, particularly after? After you left Fisk, did your dreams shift from being a teacher?
Well, let me tell you this. I can remember the major change that took place was when my sister died. I was taking philosophy courses then at Memphis State.
And this was older in life.
I took, my sister passed. I was taking philosophy courses. And you know what? They had to decide when to pull the plug. I said, that's a major decision for people to have to make. So in that I was taking philosophy, I decided that I wanted to go further in it. I wanted to be a medical ethicist. You know? And so,
By this time, when your sister passed away, I'm giving just your timeline markers, you were in your 40s, right? You had your five children. And your sister unexpectedly died. I think it was aneurysm, right? That she had.
It was 1976. Yeah, it's 38. Yeah, I'm 38 then.
You're 38. Okay. And so your dream shifted from, you know, school teacher to now a medical ethicist because the impact of your sister's death.
And it was difficult to decide. It was a difficult decision for me. And I imagine that would be difficult for anyone to decide when to pull the plug. So I thought this would be an avenue that I would go into and I hopefully be successful in helping them to get through this ordeal.
So you were in your late 30s when that happened, and you went back to school yet again. This is after 2 years at Fisk, or a year and a half at Fisk, 3 years at Northwestern, some time at University or Chicago,
Teachers College.
Teachers College, DePaul. So you went to a lot of schools.
Right? Trying to find myself.
Trying to find, you went to a lot of schools trying to find yourself. So here you are, five kids, 40, and you decide to embark upon a new major. Before you had studied, majored math, right? Mm-hmm. So now you're starting a new major in philosophy, or specifically medical ethics. I just remembered all of us going to school at the same time, okay? We were in school, you were in school, we used to follow you to your classes, mm-hmm. hang out in the hallways while you were in your classes. How long were you studying it at University of Memphis for this medical ethicist degree?
Well, you know, I was there for about, two or three years. But the problem was, I had to go to, in that I wanted to be a medical ethicist, I had to go to where the medical school was to go to this. And I had to go out of Memphis, so I knew that was blown away right there.
Oh, you couldn't do that because...
I couldn't do it, and I had to go to the, where the medical school was. To be a medical ethicist.
And so that there wasn't a medical school in Memphis. There was
no, it's in Knoxville.
Okay, the one that was connected to this program.
The program that was connected to this program, because they didn't have it at Memphis State here. Right. They didn't have that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
that was a dream dashed.
Yeah, that dash.
And when did you find that out? How long into studying?
I was into graduate courses. Mm-hmm. I was in just entering to graduate courses when I found out that I had to go to Knoxville to go to school. I knew that was out of the question.
So how did you deal with that setback, that realization, that dream dash?
Well, it didn't do me. It just didn't do me because I wasn't settled in the first place with that kind of thought of it. But you know what, then it was.
So you weren't sold 100% on the degree of medical ethicist.
Well, I wanted, but it wasn't deep in my heart.
Right.
You know. Mm-hmm. And so when that happened, I didn't lament over it because I knew that was out of the question.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the question. So that was down. But you know, at that time, I was already writing music.
That's when you started to write music.
I was writing before that.
Right.
I was writing music, but I wasn't taking that serious either.
Right. You were writing music then, but you were just doing it as just something to do.
Well, yes. You know how I got into it. I was writing music, but this wasn't anything that I had planned to do. This was something that happened. It just happened along. My sister-in-law asked me to assist her in putting together an Easter program. Well, my brother was a pastor of the church, so I kind of had to go along with her. She had so many dues to do, so she kind of dumped this in my lap. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I went about various places trying to find what I had in my mind that I wanted. And I couldn't find that. What I really wanted, I couldn't find it. So I said, well, I think what I'll do is I'll write it myself. The writing part I liked. So I put together this thing with poems and skits and all that. I put together everything. And then I decided that I'll go to the choir director to ask her to assist me with some songs. So she said, I'm very sorry, but I can't teach that. Well, number one, I wanted the songs. I wanted was Handel's Messiah. And so she said, no, I can't do that. Well, we had a...
she wasn't skilled enough to teach.
She wasn't skilled enough. Mm-hmm. But we had a music director who was skilled enough mm-hmm. to do it. And he said, no, mm-hmm. I can't. I can't. He probably didn't want to do it, but mm-hmm. he was qualified to do it. So
So that's what pushed you to write the
music yourself. Well, no, I decided I wasn't writing at that point. I still wasn't writing. Mm-hmm. But what pushed me was I started using familiar songs. But in my heart, I wanted a poem and then a skit. I wanted to have a song to follow each thing. I wanted a song to complement the poem or the skit. And I wanted a poem, but I couldn't get it. No one could help me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you couldn't find a song to complement the poem that you had written and the play.
And I couldn't find anyone to help me think of songs that would complement.
Right.
So then I just went on and used, I just put familiar hymns that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
I just used those in this work.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had everything all laid out. Now we're going to the church for rehearsal for this work. We had a visiting musician from St. Louis there.
Mm-hmm.
And, but anyway, I said, let me kind of go with one more time just to make sure I have everything together before I try to introduce it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to my bedroom, closed the door, and got my program out. Well, the first thing on the program was St. John 3:16-17. That was the first thing on the program. So I started at the beginning, and I got my Bible out to read first thing on the program, St. John 3:16. When I opened the Bible to read it, the strangest thing happened. Instead of reading it, this melody flowed from within me, and it sang St. John 3:16. The whole verse, it sang it. I had no control over beginning it or stopping it. And at the end of the verse, I said, my goodness, I said, what was that? It was frightening. What was that? And I tried to think about it, and then I just was overcome. So then, I said, well, I don't understand it, but I'll go on to the next verse.
Mm-hmm.
The next verse was the 17th verse. And of course, I attempted to read that, got ready to read it and everything. And it's just
same thing happened.
This melody flowed from within me and out of my mouth. And I sang the 17th verse.
Right.
Well, now I just shut down everything. Closed my books, closed the Bible. I said, look, this is too much for me. I don't understand it. And so I went to church, and I couldn't resist telling the young man. I said, you know what? The strangest thing happened to me. And I told him about the verses, and I sang it to him. I sang it. He said, oh, that's a pretty melody. Why don't you write a song? I said, write a song? That's out of the question. You don't understand. I'm not a music person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't play a musical instrument. That's not my thing, writing music.
Right. But then lo and behold, you took that one experience, built on it, and began a prolific writing career.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. I thought, why don't I try to just do what they given me to do. I sat down with St. John 3:16, and I wrote everything around those verses.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sat down, I said, now, Lord, you'll give me compensation. I didn't want to do it at first.
Right.
He said, I can't do it. I said, I can't do that.
Right.
He said, if God has given you two verses, I think he can give you a whole song.
That's right.
So I couldn't deny that. So I finally sat down, and I sat at the table and got everything together, and I started writing. And I started singing, and all my experience with having sung in the choir in high school and the church, and then having to take music appreciation at Fisk, all of it came together, I guess. And I implemented everything that I had been exposed to. And this came out of my singing, how the songs went, and, you know, how I remember singing sopranos and altos and all of that. So it was just wonderful.
So those are your humble beginnings of, no, I can't sing. No, I can't. I know nothing about music. I know nothing about any of that. I can't do it. I don't know how to do it. Fast forward to your, your oratorio being premiered at Carnegie Hall. How did that feel to see a dream realized?
You know, I thought when I had finished my songs, I thought that I could get them presented at my church.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, this conductor whom I had worked with in Oregon, he called me up and he said, Ernestine, we are going to have a Dr. Martin Luther King commemorative concert and we want to use your work. None of us could believe it. My first concert with the choir and everything being done at Carnegie Hall. Who ever heard of that? But my work was done at Carnegie Hall and it went so well. Before I left the building, he said, you know, I hear you are doing another work. I said, yes, I'm doing the nativity. He said, when you finish it, we want to present it. I said, well, that's strange. Before I finish it, you don't know how it's going to sound. But he told me, we want to present it.
Right.
And I got that, and I did that. And the next one was, he talked to my son. I found out I was on another one. He said, we want to do that one. Mm-hmm. And they did that one, Exodus. And that was the one that it filled the house. Mm-hmm. It filled Carnegie Hall.
So your first, what year was your first concert premiere at Carnegie Hall? Your first concert period, which happened to be Carnegie Hall. What year was that?
1997.
97. Wow. Mm-hmm. When you first started writing music, when?
72.
So you went from 72 to 97, not really having your music performed.
Oh, maybe one person would do one of the songs or something like that, but I never had it done.
You never had the whole work done.
No.
The whole work done. Oratorio, which is essentially songs and narration.
Narration.
Yeah. So, I believe you're in the Library of Congress as the first African American woman composer.
Is
that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's in the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Everything was just like a fluke or something that happened to me. I just sent my piece off to have it
copyrighted.
Mm-hmm. And they were so long, I asked my daughter, Cheryl, to help me check with these people to see why I had not gotten a receipt or something back that it was copyrighted.
Right.
And we labored a long time on telephone. Mm-hmm. Finally, the lady came and she said, Mrs. Robinson, I apologize. You should have received something. But if it's any consolation to you, the Library of Congress has chosen your piece for its special collections. I was shocked. I said, these things, surprising things just keep on happening to me.
Yes, they were happening to you, but it happened over a long period of time. So you go from 72 to 1997 to wait to have your music perform is a long wait. A lot of people have given up. So, but you kept the faith. You had your dream. And from 1972, your music has premiered at Carnegie Hall three times. Mm-hmm. Once in
Prague.
In Prague by the Czech National Symphony. And you just had the world premiere, your most recent work about Harriet Tubman, very powerful mm-hmm. piece. Other symphonies are clamoring to present it. I think that was premiered and presented by National Civil Rights Museum and performed by the Memphis Symphony Orchestra mm-hmm. and the Memphis Symphony Chorus, along with other community choirs. It was beautiful. I was there. It was just so moving. But you're working on a new piece, right?
Yeah.
At 86 years young, you're working on a new piece? What are you working
always.
On? Always.
Always? Yeah, always. I wrote a poem, and the poem was Overflowing Love. Love, Let It Overflow. Mm-hmm. And that song poem has been done so many times. I said, I think I'll write a song from that poem. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on that. And I did an oratorio, From the Cradle to the Cross. That one I'm doing. And it's three parts. The birth, his mission on earth, and the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. Well, I thought about it. I had finished it, but I thought maybe about the mission on earth, I think I'll write a couple more songs for that.
So more projects to come. Well, I'm about to enter next year. I'll be turning the six and the O. we're not calling it 60. We're calling it 6 and the O-H exclamation point, the O. So I want to know, how do you continue to dream as you age? I mean, we didn't tell the viewers, but you're 86 years old and you always have projects.
Well, I don't know, but you know what?
So what's your advice?
I was interviewed by this woman recently, mm-hmm. and she said, you know, this is not regular. This is not ordinary. It's strange to us. You're 86 and you're writing like this. And she said, tell me this. When you started out, I was in my 30s, mm-hmm. and when you write now, is there a difference? Will you come upon it? I says, no. I said, the mindset is the same. When you get the map, you feel inspired, you write. It has nothing to do with age. Mm-hmm. It's just inspiration.
Inspiration. So your advice is to go with you. Remember once you told me that the key to life is to always keep a project in front of you?
You need to. You need to keep moving. Mm-hmm. Keep moving. Keep doing.
Keep being inspired.
Keep being inspired. Inspire yourself and others. That's the secret.
And that's a wrap for today's episode. If you liked what you heard, subscribe, rate us on Apple Podcasts, and listen to When Magic Happens wherever you listen to podcasts. Special thanks to our moms, Julie, Ernestine, and Florence, for being mothers, for raising us, and for sharing their wisdom and stories with us on the podcast. We love and appreciate y'all so much. You can find me, Jennifer Shea Love Bowers, on Instagram at Being Shea Love.
You can find me, Cheryl Jackson, on social media at Cheryl Jackson. That's Cheryl with an E.
You can find me, Taylor Coward, on Instagram at Taylor Coward Online.
When Magic Happens is a production of WBEZ Chicago and part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our truly magical producer is Brianna Garrett. Brendan Banaszak is our executive producer. Tracy Brown is chief content officer. Engineering by Maria Lopez. See y'all next week.